You are listening to Mountain Money, broadcasting from KPCW, Park City, Utah.
Good morning and welcome to the February 22nd, 2021 Real Washington's Birthday edition of Mountain Money. I'm Roger Goldman. I'm here with my fabulous co-host, Allison Kulo. Good morning, Allison.
Good morning, Roger.
It was a pretty good weekend, I think, here. We had sort of the remains of the holiday crowd. The ski slopes were a little crowded, but the snow is so much better than it's been, so it's all good.
It feels like a different place now that we have snow, or back to the same old, maybe.
It feels more like normal. In a year that so little feels normal. At any rate, this morning we've got some fun guests. Our first guest is going to be David Komlos, who's going to talk to us about the time he spent over the last 9 months talking to CEOs at Fortune 500 companies to help them solve the complex challenges they faced during the pandemic.
Next up, we'll be talking with Chris Eggleton and Chris Retzer, both with Newpark Hotel and Resort. They're going to join us this morning to talk about the initiatives they pursue to keep Newpark Hotel and Resort top of mind for incoming guests. And we're going to end the hour talking with Renee Bodley Miller, KPCW's general manager, about the 2021 Winter Pledge Drive that starts next Monday. All this and more this morning on Mountain Money. Stay tuned.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. David Komlos is the CEO of Syntegrity, which is an entrepreneur. He's an entrepreneur and early stage investor and speaker who's helped change the way that many global leaders approach their top challenges. He really focuses on the concept of complexity and how that interplays with quality management.
From Fortune 100 transformation to international aid, content creation and sports and entertainment, to improving access to life-saving products, David advises top leaders and enterprises on how to dramatically accelerate solutions and execution on their defining challenges. He frequently speaks on topics related to complexity, fast problem solving, and mobilization and scaling talent. David writes about complexity for Forbes and joins us this morning to discuss what these CEOs are sharing anonymously, their top priorities for 2021, and how to tackle big, complex challenges when you can't bring your team together in person. David, thanks for joining Mountain Money this morning.
Good morning. It's great to be with you.
So, David, this project of talking to CEOs, tell us a little bit about how you came up with it and what your goal was in talking to the CEOs about over the last 9 months.
Yeah, these are CEOs of large organizations, private equity-owned organizations, governments, and so forth across various industries and sectors. And I'm regularly in touch with them just because of the work I do and the relationships I have with them. What I wanted to understand from them was what the pandemic had done to the way they look at work, the way they look at productivity, and what they were concerned about going forward while people who are able to work from home are working from home.
And I assume you saw a variety, a range of strategies, some more successful than others. Talk to us a little bit about where you saw CEOs developing effective strategies versus less effective strategies and why.
Some CEOs were very clear about the kinds of tasks that can be done remotely, and they doubled down on equipping those people who were in those tasks with the kinds of tools and technologies and training they could need. So, for example, customer service representatives working from call centers who had to move home were trained up on, you know, the differences from working together with colleagues in a call center and how they're working from home. And they didn't really experience much of a productivity drop, and some of them experienced productivity gains. CEOs had concerns about what their research and development teams would do now that there is no water cooler, and they were missing some of those opportunities to bump into each other serendipitously. They were also very concerned about standing up new initiatives, new work streams, and prosecuting new priorities where teams weren't together. They weren't as concerned about teams that already know each other and are mid-flight trying to take cost out or digitize or merge or launch a new product. But for those kinds of top priorities where they hadn't started and where there were new employees who didn't know each other, they were concerned about how these top priorities would get advanced without losing productivity, time, and missing opportunities. And for those, there's been more of a struggle. And I think that, we have to be careful, and, CEOs are saying they have to be careful not to fall into a trap of, what's emerging as conventional thinking, which is people are starting to say, well, you can't have good conversations, you know, over video with too many people, or you can't really have water cooler type dialogue over video. And that's just simply not true, but it does require proactively thinking about how to create the kind of environment that leads to that kind of productivity and creativity.
So from my understanding, you know, it felt like 2020 may have been more just survival mode, but companies can't stay in that mode, you know, for long. They do need to, as you said, you know, keep productivity high, but also make sure that they're addressing the changes that are needed in the organization. Knowing that we can't wait any longer and need to keep moving forward, what priorities have CEOs set for 2021?
The CEOs that I've spoken with, the priorities they're setting for 2021 is to really, really figure out work 2.0. What are the implications for work from home? What are the implications on real estate and on work policies and flexibility and on talent attraction and retention when things are really in flux when it comes to work processes and practices? They're also very concerned about revisiting, you know, customer experience, net promoter scores, and making sure that new ways of work and changes they make in the organization don't undermine the customer experience, the customer loyalty, customer satisfaction and retention that they've worked so hard over the years to achieve, especially in hyper-competitive environments. Those are some of the priorities. Of course, digital and digitizing has been accelerated tremendously, and CEOs don't want to miss out on the momentum that they've started in 2020. Out of necessity, they want to double down on it and start looking at it not as a necessity, but as a way to differentiate and create advantage.
You know, it's widely been discussed how disparate the impact of COVID has been on individuals, but it's also had a widely disparate impact on industries. Are there particular companies you can point to in industries that were hard hit, where CEO leadership has caused them to be able to outperform their competitors? And do you have any observations on people who really did a good job at wrestling with the complexity in an industry that was hard hit?
You know, travel is suffering dramatically, and especially hotels and conference centers, as well as retail, bricks and mortar retail has suffered tremendously during the pandemic. And there are glimmers and glimpses of organizations that have pivoted. Bricks and mortar has pivoted online to e-commerce, some more successfully than others. Same with conference organizations and hotels, looking at different ways to utilize their space, different ways to go online, different ways to leverage the loyalty programs and the currencies they have built up in those loyalty programs to get consumers taking advantage of the currency that they have and their points in ways that drive economic benefit to them and to the consumer. But, you know, hard hit industries have largely been hard hit, and there haven't been any miracles that have stood out. It's really who's going to start to hit the ground running because they spent the time deeply thinking about how they're going to, you know, get back to where they were and beyond when things start to come back.
As you've mentioned, the current situation with remote work, it's, you know, we have missed opportunities to have those dialogues at the water cooler, to run into each other and have, you know, those small time to chat. In December, you wrote about Forbes, about how the pandemic changed their approach to innovation. And I feel like you wrote for Forbes about 3M's approach to innovation. And knowing that innovation as well is more of a creative piece, how did they look at needing to change their operations?
Well, 3M, we spoke with John Banovitz, who's the chief technology officer, among other roles that he plays at 3M. And one of the big ahas for them was working more closely with suppliers. He told us that 3M had somewhat of a more insular, we can do anything kind of philosophy. And over the years, they've been incredibly, incredibly successful and innovative. The pandemic forced their hand in a way that many organizations' hands were forced to do things differently. And for 3M, they really partnered with their ecosystem and took a real learning lens on what could they learn from their supply chain partners and joint venture partners to innovate new products and also just to deliver products like the N95 masks faster and in greater volume. So for them, it was largely around partnering. I know other organizations have really been looking at how do you stand up remote teams, especially when it comes to, you know, the serendipity that you're looking for from the water cooler, innovating new products, coming up with, you know, creative launch plans for new products, commercializing new services, innovating really around any of your strategic planning efforts when people are remote. And what we find is that you can do that over video if you organize it well.
It's interesting because we've sort of touched on this a couple times now. What techniques have you seen that really work in terms of organizing videos? Anything in particular that you have seen that has been effective?
Absolutely. And I've been involved in many of these effective experiences over video over the last 6 months, whether it's, you know, retailers trying to figure out how they're going to gain more from e-commerce and shift, whether it's hospitals figuring out the patient experience while dealing with the onslaught of COVID-19 and so forth. And so the first thing to do is, you know, think about bringing more rather than fewer people into the dialogue. People are craving dialogue, deep connection with one another, especially those who are working remotely. And so giving them a question to innovate on is a really good first step. Bringing people onto Zoom or Teams or Google Meet or WebEx in numbers of 10, 15, 20, 25, 30 people, all the right players who you believe have the potential to answer the question through collaborating together, pose a really good question to them, like, what do we have to do now and over the next 90 days to make sure we don't skip a beat with customers now that we've moved remote? Or, you know, how do we grow faster during the pandemic? Or what do we have to do now and over the next 3 months to make sure we hit the ground running when things start getting back to some semblance of normalcy? Whatever the challenge is, phrase it in the form of a question and really look ambitiously across your organization and even around your organization to the people you think could contribute to answering that question. That's the first step. And then the second step is to really not just have them go at it. You know, there's features on these video platforms that allows you to distribute people into different rooms. You don't have to have everyone in one room. You can separate them into several rooms. Do that. Don't have 20 people trying to have a conversation all at once. Divide them into a few groups of 6, 8 people and have them tackle parts of the challenge. And iterate is a very important aspect to this. Iteration. So don't just have people try talking about one or two or three topics once. Have them iterate. Have them go through several conversations over perhaps a few days on the same topics. And what you'll find is that people on Zoom or Teams or WebEx or you know, the other video platforms are able to separate into teams, talk about a discussion, go back to it, revisit it, and bump into each other in between and enrich their thinking on the various parts to actually answer the question that's been posed to them. We find that to be very, very impactful, efficient, and a way to tap into everyone's creativity and desire to contribute.
And that makes a lot of sense. But one thing that we've talked about on the show before is really, you know, building organizations where open communication is accepted and asked for without fear of retribution. Does a company need to already be past that phase in order to start working together, as you've suggested on Zoom?
That's a great question. We work with a variety of different organizations that are at different levels of maturity in terms of the communication styles. And, you know, this is a problem for some. You definitely raise a really good point. But what I have found over the years is that what what organizations lack is effective ways that can be taught and practiced and institutionalized for good open communication. And that's missing more than the barrier of, you know, top-down cultures that don't really invite open communication. It's not that they don't invite open communication, it's that they don't have as much experience with really effective open communication. And so instead of trying to convince your boss or the leadership team or your teammates, et cetera, in your company that we need to have a revolutionary cultural change around becoming more open and so forth, just start small by demonstrating new ways in which to actually have that open communication. And according to some of the ways I've just mentioned, which is start with a question, think ambitiously about who should contribute to that question, and then assign them to various teams that take on parts of the question. You know, we also have a technique where we assign people to different roles in conversations. You can assign people to teams who are going to discuss something, but don't have everyone discussing it the same way. Have some people owning the conversation, have some people critiquing the conversation, and have some people observing the conversation. And when you distribute people on teams with those kinds of roles, it changes the way people talk. It gets very candid very quickly. People listen differently. People contribute differently. And when you iterate, when you do those team meetings more than once on the same topic with these kinds of roles where people are contributing differently and listening differently, you can really, really move the needle. And then it starts to become part of the fabric of the organization as opposed to something you're trying to push uphill.
You know, you've written about complexity prior to COVID. And in your book, Cracking Complexity, you talk about qualities that enable leaders to deal with complexities. I wanted to touch on a couple of those and talk about how they might perhaps have played a role in the effective handling of life in the pandemic. The first one you list in your characteristics is humble. Talk to us a little bit about what that means and how that would, you know, come into play by a leader dealing with complexity.
So we differentiate between complicated problems and challenges and complex problems and challenges, in that complicated ones are tricky for people who are encountering them for the first time, but these are essentially solved problems. If your car breaks down, that's a solved problem. You may not know how to fix it, but your mechanic does.
Somebody does.
Similarly, if you're installing a new accounting system, you may not know how to do that, but there are many consultants out there. They do that 24/7, 365. Complex challenges are like, you know, how do we grow faster? How do we take out cost? How do we merge? How do we drive a better customer experience? Those need to be figured out fresh each time. Humility is a leader that understands what he, she, or they don't know. And they understand that they don't have all the answers. They can say, I don't know the answer to this question on how we take out $100 million in costs sustainably, or how we improve our net promoter scores, or how we double our growth rate. And the ability to say, I don't know, is actually a strength. You can imagine, and in fact, John Banovitz at 3M said, you know, during the pandemic, he's found that he had never said, I don't know, nearly as much, which is something that can actually rally people around you. That kind of humility and vulnerability actually wakens people and makes them want to help you by contributing their talents.
One of the other items that you include as far as a quality of a leader that would be helpful during a time like this would be for that leader to be present. And I feel like, is that, you know, it feels like everyone's present during the pandemic, but yet I think some of us, it's a little hard for us to have our feet touch the ground during this time. How can leaders continue to be present during this?
By recognizing that their feet don't normally touch the ground. Just by the way that organizations are structured, it's the human condition, right? The further and further advancement that you have in an organization, the higher up on the perch you sit, and it's much easier to lose sight of what's really going on the ground floor. And so it's imperative, getting back to one of your other questions, about the level of communication, the frequency of communication, and who's involved in those communications in an organization. if you are relying on the upper echelon to have all the answers, that's a losing battle. There's a notion in management called the law of requisite variety that says only variety can really absorb variety. And what that means is when you're dealing with a high variety, complex challenge with lots of moving parts, how do we improve customer experience? How do we pivot to the new world post-COVID and so forth? Those are high variety challenges. You can only hope to absorb that variety by bringing an equal amount of variety to the challenge. And you do that by involving a diversity of talent from various levels of an organization. As a leader, if you're not tapping into a diversity of talent from all levels of the organization, including other people from outside your organization, consultants, vendors, partners, supply chain, et cetera, you're really not going to know exactly what's going on. And when you don't know exactly what's going on, the best you can hope to render is a partial solution to whatever challenge you're up against.
It's interesting. And I think one of the things that sort of goes to is the notion that the ability to be present not only allows you to process information better, it also creates an incentive on the part of all echelons of the company to bring forth ideas. In other words, it creates an openness of communication. Talk to us a little bit about that. How do good leaders facilitate communication among all levels to get the best ideas?
They start by recognizing that ideas can come from anywhere, not just a select group of people. And if you think about it, we tend to turn to the usual suspects, the people we know, the people who've given us good ideas in the past. And while that's a good starting point, it's not a good end point when you're dealing with complex, new, fresh challenges. Good leaders start with good questions. They look aggressively across the organization as to who to involve in solving those questions and contributing to answering those questions. They approach answering the questions with the humility that we spoke of, knowing that they don't have all the answers, and they tell the people in their organization that they don't have all the answers, and it depends on us. It doesn't depend on me. And by convening groups of people, whether it's physically or over video, giving them ways and looking for new ways in which to drive effective communication, again, using techniques like member, critic, observer, again, using techniques like iteration, not assuming that people will solve challenges or be able to get creative right away, that they have to iterate on the same topics and really soak in the subject matter to really start connecting the dots. That's what good leaders do. They understand the pace. They understand the way in which they have to involve more rather than fewer people. And that they can't just throw them into rooms hoping for productivity. They have to give them, they have to equip them with ways in which to have productive conversation. Those are the traits that really differentiate good leaders going forward from those who are going to struggle.
You know, my favorite story about getting input from multiple levels is the development of Flamin' Hot Cheetos, which, as I understand it, was stimulated by a janitor at a Frito-Lay plant who thought, you know what? You'd really create a product that would have a broad appeal if you could come up with this super hot Cheeto market. I guess that's a pretty unusual phenomenon, but it does sort of go to the notion of great ideas come from all levels.
Totally.
One more thing, as we close down the interview, you've mentioned, during our discussion about work 2.0, and, I guess my question to you is, what types of things should people be keeping in mind as we look to reimagine the workplace and not just bring it back to the way things were?
This is a singular opportunity to reinvent. It should be a deliberate top priority at all organizations to look at how they can use this as an incredible opportunity that impacts their capital expenditures, their operating costs, their bottom line, talent retention, talent attraction. I think insisting that people come back to the office who have been working remotely 5 days a week is going to be a losing battle and will become a retention and attraction challenge. This is an incredible opportunity to leverage new technologies, new platforms, invent new ways of doing work. and really looking at the jobs that need to get done in an organization and how to start to approach them in new ways. This is the huge opportunity of our era that we could not have manufactured this kind of an experiment. And so it's the organizations that look at this as an opportunity and look at it aggressively and ambitiously that will really have a leg up.
Thank you. We've been speaking with David Komlos. He has been talking to us about how Fortune 500 companies are approaching the pandemic. David, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
Mountain Money will be right back after this. Welcome back to Mountain Money. Chris Eggleton, General Manager of New Park Hotel and Resort, joins us this morning to talk about the hotel and surrounding area. And also joining him is Chris Retzer, the Director of Development. Welcome, Chris and Chris.
Hey, good morning. This is Chris Eggleton.
Good morning.
How are you guys?
Good. How are you?
Well.
Why don't you talk to us a little bit about how New Park Hotel and Resort weathered the last 11 months?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's I've been asked this question a lot, and my answer has been pretty consistently. I think about a year ago, when we were looking into this, we certainly started thinking about the worst. And I think there were some opportunities to make lemonade out of some lemons. And certainly business could be better, particularly in the hospitality segment. That's been one of the hardest hit segments across this pandemic. And, you know, Park City has fared better than some markets in our state and some markets, obviously domestically. But we've also lost a lot of opportunity as a result of what the pandemic has caused.
Chris, talk to us a little bit about your baseline market. In other words, in a normal year, what is your clientele base between, you know, tourists and business? Talk to us a little bit about who the New Park Hotel normally serves.
Yeah, so we're a boutique property on kind of the mid to upper scale. We have about 135 guest rooms. Those are a combination of standard rooms and suites with fully equipped kitchens and private freshly filled hot tubs on the balcony. And so our product tends to cater to, in the wintertime, a skier and a destination visitor. Park City has been really good at attracting those tourists for a number of years now. And when New Park was conceived 2 decades ago and a hotel was contemplated, certainly that was one of the core elements, was to chase the tourist demographic. And then we are also a meeting and conference hotel, so we have nearly 7,000 square feet of conference space. And so all year round, we have a full sales team that tries to attract and solicit corporate group and convention business.
We do have Chris Retzer on the line now as well. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning.
So one thing that you guys undertook, and this was right before the pandemic, is you transitioned from being a Hyatt property to a boutique hotel again. Tell us about why that change was important for you to make.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'd probably answer first by saying if we backed up a little bit, in 2014 and 2015, when we saw the shifting tourism landscape and hospitality landscape in Park City moving around a little bit with the acquisition of Vail coming in and trying to take over Park City, we started feeling really a lot of pressure as a small independent boutique property to be able to compete with more and more and increasing higher end and upper upscale brands in that segment. And so in 2015, Chris and I took on partners out of Colorado. They were originally the Destination Hotels brand, and those partners in Colorado ended up being on a pretty rapid growth trajectory, which we were somewhat excited about. But over the next 3 and 4 years, they ultimately sold their shares in our business to a merger with Commune Hotels to form Two Roads. And then Two Roads sold their entire portfolio, which was over 80 properties, to Hyatt. That transaction was a little bit surprising. And when Chris and I first decided to partner with Destination Hotels, they were much smaller, you know, approximately 45 properties, family-run business, and still had a lot of boutique elements. And so when the asset sale to Hyatt went through and we learned about it, we quickly started to evaluate whether or not that was something we wanted to continue to pursue. And ultimately, over about a year, it was determined we thought we would better serve our constituency, our clientele, better serve our employees, and really better serve the community by going back to fully owned, independent, and boutique.
As I understand it, some of your rooms, and I don't know how many, are actually condominiums that are owned by third parties. How do you sort of integrate the management of that in terms of, you know, booking out for conferences and similar corporate events?
Yeah, it's actually 100% of all of the inventory and residential units, dwelling units in New Park are owned by individuals. I think it was by design. New Park itself was really a thoughtful development, a first of its kind sort of town center out in Kimball Junction, intentionally designed to be off of a ski resort and focus itself on kind of the heart of where a visitor, whether you're a tourist or a convention guest, might spend, let's say, 20 hours of their day, right? Your core activity happens, you go skiing, you come back, and you got to eat, play, shop, dine, and sleep. And so when New Park came about, we knew that we were going to have to really be focused on creating a management program that awarded and afforded owners a lot of opportunity and a lot of flexibility. And so from the onset, most of the original buyers in early 2006 to 2008, pre-recession, right, were on board with the program. And then when we opened the hotel, it was actually kind of mid-2008 as the Great Recession already gotten started. And so we kind of started in the trenches, I would say, pivoted a little bit back then. And we've been working with what we consider our partners, the homeowners or the individual, maybe institutional investors that own the assets, really rely on us to do our jobs and to create basically a look, smell, feel-like hotel experience for those guests. And we couldn't operate our management company without those owner partners. And so we really have a close-knit and respectful, transparent relationship with the ownership. And I think that starts with Chris and I and our employees, kind of trickle down effect, being really deliberate to respecting that relationship.
And so with your role, both of your roles at New Park Hotel, it also consists of being a landlord as well as working with some multifamily housing in the area. Back in 2008, there was a 38-unit affordable housing project that was constructed. And as well, there's 43 market-rate apartments that were recently constructed. How are those properties doing?
Yeah, this is Chris Retzer, and I can start off on this a little bit. And this plays into the discussion with Hyatt, where we, as Chris mentioned, we are a smaller boutique property manager. And while our bread and butter is hospitality and you know, the hotel experience and meeting and conference, we also manage some retail space and some multifamily housing, and those also weren't necessarily great fits for the Hyatt model. But specific to those two properties, I can speak a little bit more to the affordable housing project and then let Chris speak to the market rate. But the affordable housing project has actually had a pretty solid year. Interestingly enough, the occupancy there usually is really heavy in the winter, and then we have a lot of people, as you would expect, kind of departing and even breaking their leases in the summer months. And I think in 2020, ironically with COVID, a lot of tenants stayed in place during the summer, and so our occupancy was higher than normal, and so the property actually performed pretty stable throughout the year, which was pretty nice. And the landlord and owner of that property also was pretty generous when COVID first hit in working with tenants and in some cases even offering free rent just to help with the burden that everyone was dealing with. So right now, yeah, that property is really stable. And as everyone knows in the community, there's heavy demand, greater demand than supply for affordable housing. And so it's usually not too bad of an issue trying to keep the units full.
And then as well, I know that you've got some market rate units.
Yeah. Yeah, so New Park Flats apartments, we're in our third year of operation, and that was realistically kind of one of the first pure apartment projects designed and built in Park City, meaning that there's no condominiums for sale, no portion of the units in inventory are owned in a condominium fashion or anything like that. It's four stories, 43 units, a combination of one bedrooms and two bedrooms, and has all the traditional features that you might come to expect at an apartment. And our real market and competitive set ends up being a lot out of Salt Lake, sometimes out of Heber. And you know, when we opened up, there was a good, strong demand to be in an apartment community and to be in New Park, where realistically you can walk to just about everything you need to. And so leading into COVID, I think we were running what we expected, which was about a 10% sort of vacancy rate. Our rents were fairly stable and we're hitting our performance numbers. And then when COVID hit, it really made the landlord and others wonder, like, what's going to happen? And with immediately sort of some rent protections, we saw that people were sticking around. But you did have a lot of job change. I think as we saw a job loss continue to increase, we saw people that were literally had just moved or relocated here to take a job in less than 45 days. They had been let go and they needed to move back or move somewhere else. And so we did see and struggle a little bit with the transition through spring of 2020. And then when I think more people realized COVID was settling in for the long haul, and larger corporations, specifically on the coastal market, started saying, we're not going back to work. We're going to stay in this remote work situation for long periods of time. We immediately saw a spike in demand. So when big tech companies out of Silicon Valley started saying, we're not coming back till 2021, the phone started ringing. San Francisco, LA, New York, all those major markets, we just saw a flood of demand. And so we're really fully occupied. We have a little bit of turnover this month, again, another job transition thing, but with a waiting list, it's been surprisingly comfortable to operate an apartment building in the notion of a Zoom town where so many people want to play and live, yet their work is somewhere else where they're no longer wanting to live.
Zoom town, boom town. Let me ask you,
yes.
physically, which building is the New Park, is the four-story apartment building? Where is it located relative to the hotel?
Yes, south. So there's kind of a horseshoe parcel right on the southern part of the project. There's a series of townhomes that were built a number of years ago, faces directly to Deer Valley and Iron Mountain. And so they have great views. For those of people that have been around a while, it's just south of Jupiter Bowl, or what was formerly Jupiter Bowl.
No, that's great. And, you know, as well, another role that you have is managing commercial tenants. And I know that there's at least been one changeover with Needers. Do you want to just give us a highlight of how those businesses are doing?
Yeah, I can speak to that. So the retail tenants we manage all are within the New Park Hotel building, which people are familiar with the property. It's, you know, Cafe Rio on the western corner, and then to the east ends with Maxwell's. And I think like all businesses, everyone was struggling and there was a lot of uncertainty as COVID hit. And then as the community started to open back up and some of these health protocols and safety protocols were put into place and officially adopted and the businesses started to stabilize again. And so overall, I think the tenants they found their footing. Obviously, they've taken advantage of, you know, local Utah grants and federal programs like the PPP loans, and those have made a big, you know, big difference in their operations. But as we communicate with everyone, I think the trajectory is back towards, you know, stabilization, and people are fairly, you know, all things considered, satisfied with their numbers. specifically in the case of Neeters, they, they decided to close all of their locations that did not have drive-thrus. And that was, I think that was something that was probably in their planning prior to when COVID happened, and then COVID accelerated their timing to implement that. And so certainly the new park location fit that criteria, and I guess in other words, no longer fits their formula at a corporate level, where the drive-thru is a pretty big part of their sales volume. And so they closed their doors right as COVID began. And we worked over the summer to find a replacement tenant, and in the fall ended up signing a lease with a coffee house operator out of Salt Lake called Coupla. And some people may know, but it's a couple twins, Beth and Abigail, that used to be the baristas at Park City Coffee Roasters. And they went down to Salt Lake a couple years ago, and they have two locations down there that they're operating. And they have great energy and a pretty amazing product. And so they're going to, open this coffee house and bakery. And they're planning to do, some breakfast and lunch options as well. And we're really, really excited for them to join the new park community.
And when do you expect them to open?
Unfortunately, I don't have a definitive answer at this point. They're they're working through some permitting issues and a couple, I would say, unexpected requirements from the county.
Shocking.
That came up in terms of bringing the property up to code. So we're hoping it might be sometime in the next like 4 to 6 weeks, but it's a little bit, it could be faster than that, but also slower. So that's probably the best answer I can give.
Well, you guys definitely have a lot going on, and we appreciate you taking the time to come and chat with us. We've been speaking with Chris Eggleton and Chris Retzer with the New Park Hotel and Resort, and we will be right back on Mountain Money.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. This morning, we have our general manager and president, Renee Bodley Miller. For those of you who have been listening to us recently, you've noticed some really, really fun promos with music from the great Bee Gees number, Stayin' Alive, as we get ready for our Stayin' Alive 2021 Spring Pledge Drive. What's coming up, Renee?
Hi, Roger. Hi, Allison. And hello, everyone out there in Wasatch and Summit counties. It's our winter pledge drive coming up. It's so close to spring, so I understand why you'd say spring.
Spring's on my mind.
Our winter pledge drive kicks off next Monday. It goes March 1st through March 4th. Our goal, you guys, is to raise $200,000 in 4 days. We did that last year, but what was unusual about last year was our pledge drive was the week before the pandemic hit. So it's a little audacious. It's kind of a big goal to try to raise the same amount of money we did the year before. But fingers crossed, we're going to try to do it.
But KPCW has been taking such a role with regards to the pandemic and the community. So it's not that you were able to kind of sit back and relax over the last 11 months. If anything, your job has gotten bigger and harder.
Yeah, ask Leslie Thatcher if she's been sitting back and relaxing over the past year. Hasn't happened. That news team has been working harder than ever, and all of us at KPCW has for that very reason, Allison. As the news became that much more important over the last year, we really had to rev up our news team. And as you guys know, we've added Sean Higgins and Jessica Lowell. They replaced Emily Means and David Boyle, who left us last year. And we staggered their schedules. So now you have Sean Means on as a reporter on Saturday, and Jessica's on as a reporter on Sunday. It's a way that we decided to expand our news coverage because news still happens on the weekends. We're not a sleepy little resort community anymore. There's stuff happening 7 days a week. So when there are things happening like a ski patrol educational picket going on at the base or a Trump train rolling down Main Street, we've got reporters on the weekend who are now covering it. And they're also providing local news cut-ins during Saturday and Sunday morning weekend edition. So when you're stuck in traffic on 224 or 248 trying to get to the resort, you're wondering if the parking lots are full, you're wondering if lifts are on wind hold, you're wondering, what the backcountry conditions are like, which has been really important this year. Sean and Jessica are on the weekend mornings to tell you that.
So, Renee, we ask for money a couple times a year. People wonder, what do we use the money for? What do we spend money on here at KPCW? What are they getting for their donation?
Great question. We have a $1.5 million operating budget. So every year it costs us $1.5 million to run this radio station. And every year I have to do a report to the Corporation for Public Broadcasting about how many hours of locally produced programming we provide. And we provide in 1 year 3,484 hours of music, 206 hours based on arts and culture. That's through our interviews and public affairs programming. News, 1,300 hours of local news. And then we do other things like high school football games and other assorted live broadcasts. But that costs money. So I figured out for our news department and our news costs, we've got a 5-person news department. We do on average about 80, 85 stories a week. And that costs approximately $25 to $30 a story, which I think is a bargain if you factor that out. So when you're calling and making a $25 pledge during our pledge drive, you're in essence helping to pay for one story. And that one story is broadcast in the morning, in the afternoon. It goes online. I think we give you pretty good value for your buck. You know, we're a nonprofit media organization, which means we're not owned by a big corporation. We don't have shareholders that sit somewhere in a far-off city that aren't invested in the community.
And I think one of the important things that you've been talking a bit about is just local news. And this year we've heard both the Salt Lake Tribune and the Deseret News are not going to be publishing as frequently. And so how do you get that news to people, and why is local news important?
Oh, gosh. You know, studies have shown, and this is through the Pew Research Center, and even Scientific American, the magazine, did a story about how communities with a local news source are more educated, more civically engaged, less politically divisive. And the way they figured that out was straight ticket voting. You know, when someone just goes in the booth and hits all R's or all D's, there's less of that when there's a local news source. I think people become more aware of the intricacies involved in public policy making. We have a lot of our elected officials on air. You have more accountability for those government officials, which is really important, especially these days. And we found, by the way, in this last election year, we cover Summit and Wasatch counties, and 21,400 and some people voted for Biden, and 21,100 some people voted for Trump. So we're a politically divided community in Summit and Wasatch counties, yet I think that we have a reputation of getting along with each other because we can have civic discourse.
One of the things we just talked about is the resources it takes for us to gather the news. But I want to talk a little bit about the different ways in which we are making that news accessible. In particular, how are we moving things forward on the digital front?
You have to meet the consumer where the consumer is, right? And more consumers are getting their news on their mobile phones, on the internet. And so we have streaming services, so you can listen to KPCW wherever you are in the world. You can stay in touch with your community. We have our website. All of our news stories are online. The more news we do, the more people we need to help put that online. That's an additional expense. The mobile app is important. We're trying to put more things on social media sites where people are, so you'll see links to our stories on Facebook. We're trying to get more things out on Instagram. We saw a huge increase in our Instagram followers this past year. Yeah, you're right, Roger. You have to put more. We're not just a radio station. That's what we try to tell people. We are a news and information delivery source. So if you don't listen to us on the radio, listen to us on your smart speaker at home or through the mobile app.
And I think back to having the reporters work on the weekends, I've been able to see that KPCW's got the story about maybe there was an avalanche at the canyons or something like that. And so I know I've been able to go and get that news over the weekend as well.
Yeah.
I also want to touch a little bit about how our news gathering importance went up during COVID, but so did our expenses. Talk a little bit about, you know, what we had to spend money on and what we're having to spend money on in terms of increased cost as a result of the pandemic.
Well, the expenses really came down to pushing things out on the digital platform. We had to hire someone to help us get our stories up online. But then because of the COVID pandemic, we had to limit the number of volunteers we had in the station. And that meant that, and sadly, we had to say goodbye to a lot of our volunteer DJs And fortunately, we had some good DJs in place who could make a commitment to us on a weekly shift basis because we were able to pay them. But that was an expense that we did incur, and we thank those DJs who came in and made that commitment. And we, of course, hope to have our volunteers back. But right now in this pandemic, that's a much added expense. And another big loss that we had in revenue is so much of our underwriters, which is another way we bring in money. They come from performing arts organizations, the Egyptian Theater, Park City Film, Park City Institute. Some of the concert halls down in Salt Lake would spend money to underwrite on KPCW to promote their shows. They're not doing those shows, so they don't need to promote, which means we don't get that underwriting revenue. So we've taken a hit there.
We've got just a few more seconds. Can you let us know, is there anything else you need for the pledge drive? From my understanding, you know, you do coordinate with the local nonprofits. Is there anything anyone can help you so that you're more successful next week?
Thank you. We do ask for profit sponsors to sponsor the nonprofit hour. We're still looking for a sponsor for the Summit County Park City Arts Council. We're looking for a sponsor for Mountain Town Music. Recycle Utah. Surely somebody wants to put up a $1,000 sponsorship for that Recycle Utah hour. That sponsorship helps those nonprofits earn free underwriting as a thank you for coming on and helping us with our pledge drive. So give me a shout here at the station or email renee@kpcw.org, renai@kpcw.org. Thanks,
we
you guys.
Appreciate it. Thanks, Renee, for coming in. And for all our listeners, we're hoping that you stay tuned next week for the Winter Pledge Drive.
Welcome back. We want to thank our sponsors. We could not do a show like this without our wonderful sponsors. Jans Mountain Outfitters, First Community Bank, Columbus Pacific Development, with Pendry Residences, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, and San Francisco Design.
And to give you a quick rundown, we had David Komlos. He was chatting with us about the Fortune 500 companies and how they're approaching the pandemic. Chris Eggleton and Chris Retzer with New Park Hotel and Resort. And Renee Bodily Miller, GM of KPCW.
You've been listening to Mountain Money, broadcast on KPCW, Park City, Utah. For more information, please visit kpcw.org. Please take a moment and give us a rating on your podcast app.